Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Yudalit Amud Bet at the two dots. The Gemara here is going through in fast sequence many of the items that we saw in the Mishnah, some of which we explained already when we spoke about the Mishnah. But here the Gemara is going into the details about each of these items and how do we know why we need 23 or 3 in each of these instances, or what is the case that the Mishnah is speaking about. So in the first instance over here, it speaks about the Arachina Mitaltalin. And there in the Mishnah, it's somewhat ambiguous as to what it's speaking about. And here the Gemara tries to clarify what exactly it is meant by Arachin HaMitaltalin that is mentioned in the Mishnah. And that's the Gemara asks, my Arachin HaMitaltalin. Amar Rav Gidol Marav, Bomer Erech Lizeh Alai. When the individual says that the value of this utensil is upon me. Now, the word Erech has a very specific meaning in the Torah at the end of Sefer Vayikra, which means that a person is pledging the value based on the fixed tables at the end of Vayikra to the Mikdash. And it usually involves them specifying a particular individual. And then based on that individual's age and gender, there'll be a price or amount of money that you would give to the Mikdash. Well, here where the person uses the term Erech with regards to a Kli, in some senses it's a meaningless statement because Erech doesn't have application by Kli. Damar Gavido Amarav, Homer Erech Li Zeh Alai Notein Davav. So here, Rav Gidol Amarav says that when you make a statement like that, as the Balei Tosfot point out, this seems to be resting or leaning on the Shita of Rabbi Meir, Damar Ein Adam Motzi Dvarav LeBatala. When a person speaks or a person articulates something, they don't do it in vain. They have intent with what they're doing. And so therefore we're going to reinterpret the statement to make some sense over here. And so therefore when a person says Erech Li Zeh Alai, we're going to reinterpret it to mean that you want to give the value of this Kli to the Mikdash. My time, Adam Yudea Shein Erech Lekli. Everybody knows that the word Erech is inapplicable by a Kli. V'gamar v'amar l'shum damim. And therefore he must mean that it's talking about the value of the Kli. And that's what he's saying over here. That Erech Kli Alai means that I want to give the value of this utensil to the Mikdash. Shum hachi notein damav. That's why you give the value to the Mikdash, even though it's not relevant to the tables that are at the end of Sefer Vayikra. Hi, Arachin HaMitaltalin. When it says, then why should it say in the Mishnah, Arachin HaMitaltalin, Arachin Shel Mitaltalin Mi Bayilei. The case here is really a case where it's Arachin of Mitaltalin. It's not Arachin that are Mitaltalin, but rather Arachin of Mitaltalin, using the word Erech with regards to a Davar HaMitaltel. And then where it says today, Arachin Shel Mitaltalin, Enochanami, you can amend the Mishnah to read Arachin Shel Mitaltalin, according to this view of a Megiddo Amarav. Rav Chista Amar, Avyime B'matpis Mitaltalin Arachin. It's a case where someone says that they are going to give their value to the Mikdash, and then they now want to pay it in kind. Instead of giving cash to the Mikdash for the Erech that they pledged, they actually want to give Mitaltalin. They want to pay in kind with items that are not cash. Hai Arachin HaMitaltalin. Mar says that's an interesting explanation, but again, the wording of the Mishnah does not support it, because the wording of the Mishnah says Arachim HaMitaltalin. Rather, it should be Mitaltalin Sherl Arachin Mibayilei. The wording in the Mishnah should have been that these are Mitaltalin that are fulfilling the pledge of Arachin, not the other way around, where it's Arachin HaMitaltalin. The Gemara again says Tanei Mitaltalin Sherl Arachin. If you're going to follow this position of Rav Chista as to what the meaning of this wording is in the Mishnah, then you will have to amend the Mishnah to read Mitaltalin Shel Arachin. Rabbi Bawa Amar, Bomer Erki Alai. The case where a person pledges their Erech to the Mikdash, Bakoin the Gabot Mimenu. But the person either didn't pay it, and now the Kohen's coming to collect, or the possibility that the individual himself doesn't have means by which to pay it. There the Torah tells us that Imachu Me'erkecha, if a person is too poor to pay the Erech, then the Kohen assesses the capability of the individual to pay, and then they reassign the value that you're going to pay. You'll pay cents on the dollar depending on what they assess your means as. So over here, you might be, and this helps the situation a little bit, the Rashash notes this, which is otherwise, why does it have anything to do with Arachin at all? But what it seems to be is that the individual is not paying it because he doesn't have the means by which to pay it. So first of all, you have to bring in three individuals to assess what is this person's capability to pay over here. So that might be what's connected to Arachin over here, and that's not Shayach to Hekdesh in general. But then there's a second statement over here, which is, once the Kohen Balik vote, when he comes to collect Mimenu, Mitaltalin Bishlosha, if he takes as collateral, or if he takes in payment mental talin, then you need three individuals to determine what the value of that item is. Karkaot v'asara. And if he takes land to fulfill the obligation, then he needs 10 people to assess the value of the land. We'll get to that in 1 second in the Gemara, but those are the standard policies by Hekdesh. When we deal with the valuation of Metaltalin, we deal with 3. And we deal with Karkaot, we deal with 10. So, again, the Rashash asks over here, so then why is it even relevant to mention the word Arachin? And that's why I said before that the explanation over here might likely be that there's 2 stages to this. The one first stage is that the individual does not have the means to pay the Arachin that he was supposed to pay. And then secondarily, if he doesn't pay, then how do we get it out of him, or how do we assign the values to the objects that we're trying to determine or take in lieu of his payment of the arachin? Amale Ravacha midifti Ravina, Pishlamala Fuke Mekdesh Beinan Shlosha. Makes sense that when you want to take something from Hekdesh, that you need 3 individuals to determine the value. Over there, we're trying to figure out how much a person has to pay to redeem this item from Hekdesh. Over there, it makes sense you need 3 to assess it, so that Hekdesh doesn't get cheated. When you're giving items to Hekdesh, why do we need an assessment of value? Over here, it's going to Hekdesh, it's not coming out of Hekdesh. So Amale, he says back to him, Svaruhu. It's a logical argument. What's the difference between objects coming into Hekdesh's possession versus objects leaving Hekdesh's possession? Afuke, my taimo. What's the reason when Hekdesh is selling an item to you and you're paying for it, we need a proper assessment by 3 individuals? Because Dilma toy, because there might be a mistake that's made. And if there's a mistake that's made, then Hekdesh loses out. Yulei Nami. The same thing is true when you're giving an object to Hekdesh, and you should have to assign a value to it based on 3 individuals, Dilma toy. Because the same problem that you have when you're buying from Hekdesh can happen when Hekdesh is buying from you, which is that you might misassign or misvalue the property. And if that's the case, Hekdesh could sometimes benefit, but many times could lose from that because somebody overvalues the property, overvalues the metalpolin, and then the person gives that in kind or in lieu of payment, and then Hekdesh loses out because they don't get the full value of what they're supposed to get. And so therefore, whether it's coming into Hekdesh's possession or leaving Hekdesh's possession, there's a need for 3 individuals in order to assess the value of the object so that Hekdesh gets a fair value, whether it's being used to pay them or it's whether it's being sold in order for them to monetize it. Now, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, so now Rabbi Yehuda says, in this situation where you have these 3 people that have to assess the value, Rabbi Yehuda says that one of them has to be a kohen. So I'm going to Rabbi Yehuda, Hainu Dichtiv Kohen. According to Rabbi Yehuda, it makes sense why you need a kohen, because that's why it says kohen in the parsha. El Rabbonon, kohen, lamalahu. Why is the word kohen, or why is that kohen mentioned at all in the parsha, if they don't require a kohen to be one of the 3 assessors over here? So where it says kasha, that is a good question. And we don't know why the Chachamim in their position do not require a Kohen, whereas Rabbi Yehuda, who does require a Kohen, makes sense that he requires a Kohen, because the word Kohen is mentioned numerous times in the Parshiot at the end of Sefer Vayikra, dealing with the redemption of items from Hekdesh, where you are trying to assign a value to an object and then redeem the object. Over there, the word Kohen is mentioned numerous times, and therefore it makes sense that you would require at least a Kohen to be a part of this process of redemption. Hakargot tisha b'kohen. When it comes to land, we said that you need 10 individuals, and the Mishnah tells us that 9 of them can be lay people, and one of them has to be a kohen. But now, how do you know that that's the makeup of the assessing body of the real property that has been given to Hekdesh? So, Amar Shmuel, asara kohanim tovim b'parsha. We mentioned this in yesterday's daf, but the word kohen is mentioned 10 times in the parsha. Now, it's not only by Karkaot. Karkaot happens to be the last of the Parshiot over there, but the 2 Parshiot before that also deal with redemption, one dealing with the redemption of Arachin, one of dealing with redemption of animals, and then the last one dealing with the redemption of Karka. And those 3 Parshiot, if you add up the word Kohen, it adds up to be 10 times that it's there. So Gemara says, okay, so it says 10 times Kohen, you would think that you need 10 Kohanim to do this. So Gemara says, no, Chad Gufei. The first Kohen comes to tell you that you need a Kohen. That's the one Kohen that we're mentioning. Hanach, the remaining 9 are Avi Miut Achar Miut. It is a principle that we have in the Halachot She'atorah Nidreshet Bahem, which is that whenever you have a Miut, an exclusion, and then following that you have a similar exclusion, Ein Miut Achar Miut El Rabot. Or in essence, the way we would think about it is today, 2 negatives make a positive. If you say a negative twice, a double negative turns out to be a positive. And so that's what's happening here. If you mention Kohen once, and then you mention it again, So then those two exclusions to say kohen only teach you that it just can't be kohen only. It has to be something that's more generic. Obviously, in our case over here, it's less understandable than it is in some other instances. By some other instances, you can understand how a double negative could result in a positive. Over here, if it says the word kohen, why wouldn't you think it means kohen? So the way to explain that is to suggest that the Torah, and we see this in other cases, for instance, if you have two drashot that come from two different psukim, then they don't teach us anything. Because we said, if it wanted to teach us something, it would have said it once. And then that would have been a paradigm from which we would have extrapolated the din. Then, once you say it a second time, that comes to tell you that these are the exceptions and not the rule. So in a similar vein over here, where it uses the terminology in the Torah, it uses the terminology once, it comes to tell you that this specific individual or this specific person is the one we want to use, but nobody else can be used. Once you start using the term over and over again, it, in a sense, loses its power as being an exclusive term. It then becomes the generic term that the Torah is using for this parshiyah. So it happens to be that we're speaking about Vayikra, Torat Kohanim, and the Kohanim are a big part of it. So the Torah uses the word Kohen, or the person, the Kohen, to describe what's happening there. But then the Kohen is just an example of an individual, but not particularly that it has to be a Kohen. So that what happens when you have this type of repetition of the item, which is Ein Miut, Achar Miut, that you don't only have to use a kohen, you can even use lay people in this instance. So one of those two reasons that miyot acham yichud doesn't work, either because, similar to, if you have two limudim that come to teach you the same thing, we would say the first one is a paradigm, the second one comes to teach you that these are the exceptions and it's no longer a paradigm. So too over here, the multiple usage of the word kohen tells you that the first one is not paradigmatic in nature, but rather just a word that's used here, and therefore they're all not meaningful. Or the second way that we explained it, which is just that if you use a word once, then you know that the Torah is emphasizing the usage of this term to tell you that that's it and nothing else. Whereas when it uses it over and over again, it's basically saying that this is an example, but not exclusive in nature. So for that reason, da'afilu tet b'yisrael v'echad kohen, therefore even if you have 9 Yisraelim and 1 kohen, that would suffice in our case. And of course, if you had 10 kohenim, it would work as well. It's just telling you that you do not have to have 10 kohenim. You have to have 1 kohen at minimum, and the remainder could be 9 Yisraelim. Now, matrif la Rav Huna brei de Rav Natan, ema chamisha kohenim v'chamisha Yisraelim. Why don't you say that you require 5 kohenim and 5 Yisraelim? He's thinking in this manner, which is that every time you mention the word kohen, then the first kohen is the gufei, to tell you you need a kohen, and the second one comes to teach you, ein miyot achar miyot ele rabot. So it means the first one you would take literally to mean Kohen. The second one we would say, well, Ein Miut Acham Miut El Rabot, that's Israel. Then the third word, Kohen, would then start again and say, okay, you need a Kohen. The fourth word, Kohen, would then be a Miut, Acham Miut, and El Rabot. So if you keep doing that, then every other time that the word Kohen is used, you would say that it's a Ribui, and then you can include Israel. If that's the case, you would require 5 Kohenim as the base of the word Kohen each time. And the second time you use the word Kohen every time, that would be rebote Israel, so you'd have 5 Yisraelim. Gemara leaves that as a kasha, an unresolved issue. You could ask the question even differently here, which is that generally, when we have Ein Miut Achar Miut El Rabot, you don't leave the first Kohen intact. Which is that, if you have two statements that are exclusive in nature, Kohen, not Israel, Kohen, not Israel, then when you say Ein Miut Achar Miut El Rabot, usually the ribui comes and wipes out both time words there. It means that the Kohen is not meaningful at all. Not the first word Kohen, not the second word Kohen, and you wouldn't require Kohen at all. So you could ask that question from the other perspective, which it would answer our question here, why don't you use 5 and 5? But then it would open the other problem, which is, why do you need 1 Kohen at all? Once you have Ein Miut Achar Miut El Rabot, that would teach you that you would always be merabeh anybody across the board. And there would be no requirement at all for a single Kohen over here. That question, in some ways, alleviates the question that the Gemara is asking about the 5 and the 5, but then opens up the other side of this is, why do you need a base Kohen? Why do you need a Kohen the Gufei? So some want to suggest that it has to do with the way that the Parshiot are written. Either because there's a Heya Yediyah used by some of the Kohanim that are mentioned in the Parsha, which comes to tell you that Ha Kohen is a little stronger terminology and demands that there be at least 1 Kohen there. Or the possibility, as we mentioned before, that the word Kohen does not appear in a single Parshiah. It appears in 3 Parshiot that come in a row over there. And therefore, you don't have the normal latitude to break it up like you would do normally and say that one coin yes, one coin no, or the other way around, to say this wipes out this coin and doesn't wipe out that coin, one coin would be fixed in nature, and then the remainders, we would say, are the rabot. So again, maybe because of the way that it turns out to be written in the psukim would give us more latitude in terms of the drasha, and that's what Chazal came up with, or the Masorah that they had, was that it has to be one Kohen and 9 Yisraelim. Badam kiyotzibhem. A person is similar to karkaot, which means that just like karka requires 10, so does an Adam. Adam mi kadosh. Mar says, since when does a person kadosh? So now, the Rishonim, Valitus would ask over here, what do you mean? We have instance of that, we're actually going to have it upcoming in the Gemara, which is if you're makdish, you're evet. If a person's makdish is evet kanani, and evet kanani has a status like karka, and so then it would make a lot of sense here that you would say that the assessment of value for the Eved Kanani should be the same as Karka. If that's the case, you would require 10 individuals. So why does the Gemara even have a question about this? So the Bali Tosafot suggests over here, it's based on the person who says that if you're Makdishan Eved, you actually don't need to be Makdishim to sanctify him, but rather to free him. And he goes, Lecherut. According to that opinion, then being Makdish and Eved has no meaning in this context, because being Makdish and Eved actually will result in his being freed rather than resulting in somebody being Hekdesh. And so that's not Adam Hekdesh. Or the Mishnah should have said it more explicitly. You shouldn't have used the term Adam, you should have used the words Eved. That Eved Kiyotzebo, that Eved is the same as a Karka. Why mention the word Adam if you want to talk and speak about an Eved? An Eved would be a much more descriptive term to use over here and much more understandable in this case. For that reason, the Rishonim say over here that the Gemara is asking the question, even though it had in the back pocket that answer, which it's not going to use, either because it's like those opinions that don't believe that there's hektesh by an Eved, or the Mishnah should have said it more explicitly. So Amar Bo, Bomer Demei Alai. It's a case where a person sanctifies their value to hektesh. The Tanya, Homer Demei Alai, person who sanctifies their value to hektesh, how do you assign the value to an individual? Today, it's extremely difficult to do that, to try to figure out what the value or the true value of an individual is, at least monetarily. So Shemino To, in their day, there was an active slave trade. So in an active slave trade, you can go and get the value of an individual, you can put them up for sale in the auction, and you can see what a person fetches. So that would be exactly the way that we would assign the value or determine the value of here. Shemino To ke Eved anim kar b'shuk. You would assess how much this person would sell for in the shuk as an Eved. The Eved kesh the karkot. And since you're selling him like an Eved, and an Eved is hukash the karkaot, therefore you require 10 individuals to assign the value to this person, but you could also see it being something that's difficult to figure out the value of the individual, and that's why you'd want 10 here, just like by karkaot, where these are a little more amorphous in nature in terms of determining their value because of location, because of the nature of the property, and the same with an Eved or an individual. No person is so simple that you can just assign a value to them. When they're selling it in the auction, there are many factors that come into play, and therefore you'd need 10 people to assess the value. All right. By Rabbi Avin, Si'ar ha'omeg l'gzos. If you have hair that is going to be cut off, and that's hair that is long enough that a person would remove it, in that case, bekama, how many people you need to assign the value or assess the value of that hair? Kika zuzdami. Do we assume that it's as if cut? And since it will be cut, and it's ready to be cut, it's as if cut, ubishlosha, therefore it's metaltalin, and you'd only need 3. Oke mechuber dami. Or do you view it as being attached? And if it's attached, then ubasara. Then you need 10 people to assess the value. So over here, you're ready, you see, what does it mean that you need 10 people over here? That what is it attached to? It's attached to the person. The person you're speaking about here is an Eved. So you see over here that for an Eved, or the value of an Eved, you need 10 individuals. And that could have been the easy answer to the question the Gemara posed before. The fact that the Gemara didn't give that answer is indicative of the fact that they didn't feel that that was what the Mishnah was speaking about, and that's what we discussed before. But now the Gemara wants to understand here, when you have something that is ready to be taken off and will be taken off, how do we view it? Do we view it as if taken off, or do we view it still as being mechubar? And since it's now mechubar, then you would have to do it ba'asara. And as Tosafot points out over here, kan mashma, tashma, magdishit abdo, ein mo'alim bo. Person is magdish's eved, there's no mi'ilah, which means that you can't misappropriate the eved and then have to pay hekdesh for misappropriating hekdesh. Rishim Gamil merit mo'alim bisa'aro. Rishim Gamil says, yes, there is mi'ilah, but it's not with the eved himself, but that's with his hair. The kaimelon, and we establish over there, bisa'aro made the gazos plige. The machloket revolves around hair that is ready to be cut. Shma Minam. So there you see that there is this machloket about what the status of the hair of the Eved is. And from here you see that the person who's makdish et his Eved ain mo'alin bo. There is no mi'ilah. So Tosva points out over here, kan mashma, de ain mi'ilah b'chubar. There's no such concept as mi'ilah b'chubar. So if there is no mi'ilah b'chubar, the Tanakam over here thinks that the hair is classified as mechubar, and you would acquire asara. Shimon Gamaliel, on the other hand, who says that there is mi'ilah over here, must think that these are metaltalin, or the hair is metaltalin, and therefore you require three. So the answer to the question as to whether you need 10 or 3 depends on what you think with regards to mi'ilah of the hair of the Eved. If you think that there is mi'ilah, then it's metaltalin, and you need 3 like Shimon Gamaliel. If you think that it is mechubar to the Eved, and therefore there is no mi'ilah, then you would require asara to assess the value because it's considered to be mechubar. This concept, how do we view objects that are in a state that they will not remain? So you have that in other instances we're going to see in a second in the Gemara, like something that's ready to be picked. It's so ripe, it's ready to be picked, and now if you don't pick it, what is the status of that fruit? Is that fruit considered to be mechubar to the karka, mechubar to the eitz? Or is it already considered to be separate and independent of the tree? So you have this concept or question that comes up many places in Shas and in many different contexts. And in each of those times, we ask the question, when something is no longer connected integrally to the object that it's on, does it still have the same status as the object? And that's what the Gemara is saying over here. The hair of the Eved is not going to remain on the Eved. It's going to be cut off. Rashi over here discusses what they would do with the hair. People can make it into a sieve. They can make it into other objects that you would use the hair for. So it has value independent of the Eved. Question is, what type of value do you assign to it? Is it like what you're suggesting? It's the Eved, and it's his hair. So it's all one object. That would mean that you think it's mechubar. That even though it's ready to be cut off, and it will be cut off, it's still right now attached to him, and therefore it'll be assigned the value as if it's attached to him, and it'll just be a part and parcel of the Eved himself. Or do we already view it as an independent entity, and therefore you have to assign a separate value to it, independent of the value of the Eved? That's exactly the question. The answer is based on this machloket between the Tanakam and Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Where it says, Nehmahane Tanei, Kahane Tanei. Let us say that this machloket Tanaim is similar to another machloket Tanaim that we have, that's not. There's certain items that are like land or real property, but Einan Kakarka, in the end, they don't have a status of real property. But the Chachamim don't agree to what he's saying. Ketzad, what's this example that Rabbi Meir is suggesting? Esther Gifanim to note, Mesarti Lecha, you have 10 vines that are laden with grapes, ripe grapes. And that's what I gave to you. I mean, that's what I lent to you, I gave to you. He says, yes, you did give it to me, but you only gave me 5 vines laden with fruit that were ripe, but not the 10 that you're saying. So now, is that considered or classified as modeh b'mitzvat or not? It has implications in terms of taking a shvuah. That is because we learned in Bava Kama, we've seen this before, we'll see it again in Shvuot, that one does not take a shvuah on karka. So if it's classified as karka, even if he's modeh b'mitzvat over here, it would not have any implications, he would not have to take a shvuah. On the other hand, if you consider it to be a metaltel, something that is separated from the karka, something independent of the karka, then this would be a case of modeh b'mitzvat, because he's saying 5 and not 10. And therefore, he would require a shvuah. So Rabbi Meir Mechayev, Rabbi Meir says there is a din of modeh b'mitzvat over here. Anything that's attached to the ground is classified like the ground. Well, Rabbi Meir's got to agree with that. Rabbi Meir's got to agree that something planted in the ground, attached to the ground, has the same status of the ground. So one, what exactly is their machloket? We're talking about grapes that are fully ripe, so mature that they're ready to be picked at this moment. Rabbi Meir looks at them as if they are already picked, meaning that since they no longer need to be sustained by the vines, they no longer need the karka at all, and we'll see in a second it's actually detrimental to them to stay on the tree, then we look at it as if they're taken off the tree already. Even though they're physically and practically still attached to the vine, we look at it as if they're now a separate entity. On the other hand, the Chachamim believe, as long as they're physically attached, they still have a status of being mechubar the karka. So what the Gemara is suggesting over here, this machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim should be similar to the machloket that we have here between the Tanakam and Rashim and Gamliel, or the machloket about what to do with the hair of the Eved. So now the Gemara says, lo, that you can differentiate in these cases. Afilu teimer Rabbi Meir. Even Rabbi Meir in our case could agree that it's classified as mechubar. Ad kan lo kama Rabbi Meir hotam. By the grapes, the reason Rabbi Meir says that it's considered to be as if picked, kol kama deshavka lo mikhash kechashe. As long as you leave them on the vine, they will deteriorate. They will be to their detriment to leave them there. It is not beneficial to leave them on the vine any longer. And therefore, you've used them as if picked. Of al saro, when it comes to the hair of the individual, kol kama deshavka lo ashbuche mishmashbach. As long as you leave it on his head, it'll continue to grow. It'll actually be better off. You might get more hair instead of less hair, or the amount that you're cutting right now. So the hair does not deteriorate by staying on the head. It actually might even be beneficial for it to stay on the head. So maybe over there, Rabbi Meir would agree that we consider it to be mechubar. Now from this, the Baal HaTosfot also mentioned it a little bit over here, but in other places in Shas, they mention it explicitly, which is that this principle, which is found throughout Shas in many different contexts, kol ha'made with something, is considered as if done. Do we apply that principle? Do not apply that principle. You can see over here very clearly that Rabbi Meir does apply the principle, and the Chachamim say no. What the Baal HaTosfot say is that it really depends on context. Context will impact here, and therefore you cannot say just because Rabbi Meir says it here means that he'll say it somewhere else. As the Gemara explained over here, that even though he says it here, he may not say it by an Eved, and the same is true by a creditor. A creditor that is coming to collect from real property, and you have these fully ripened fruits on the property, are those considered to be karka, which he has a lien on, he has a right to collect from, or are those considered to be metaltalin, he doesn't have a right to? So for there, most people believe that it's considered to be metaltalin. So even those that over here think that it's considered to be mechubar the karka, over there think it's metaltalin. That's because a creditor does not rely on those items for his collection. A creditor relies on repayment or objects that he has a lien on that remain and stay around. They're not going to disappear. The grapes on the vines are going to get picked. They're going to disappear. And therefore, he doesn't rely on them to be his collateral. He relies on the land itself or the vines themselves that are not walking to be his collateral. And so there, even though, again, you might believe, in our case, like Rabbi Meir says that, by modem mixad, it's considered as if it's picked, and the Chachamim say, no, it's not. Over there, by the creditor, maybe the Chachamim, or likely the Chachamim would agree, and that it's considered to be as picked, because the creditor does not rely on it. And the Baal HaTosafot give other examples of it here, but more extensively in other places, point out that this principle is not a universal principle that you can apply. Just because you believe in it in one case, doesn't necessarily extrapolate to other cases. Each case has to be looked at independently and in its context. All right, now the Gemara continues. Dini nefashot. The Mishnah says that when it comes to capital crimes, you require 23. And then the Mishnah continues to discuss bestiality, which also requires a beit din of 23. That is both for the death sentence for the individual, as well as the death sentence of the animal. We saw that because of the hekesh between the animal and the individual. Therefore, they are assigned the same beit din and same punishments as the Torah spells out. So now, the psukim in Parshat Kedoshim say, "Be'ish ashe yiten shchavto bebehema, mot yumat, heta behema tarogu." So that's one pasuk. The subsequent pasuk says after that, Isha, asher tikrav kol behema liv a ota, barak deta isha, deta behema, mot yumatu dmehem bam. So here you have for both a male and a female in the act of bestiality that there is a death penalty for the person that's involved, as well as for the animal that is involved. The death penalty that is assigned to them is dmehem bam, which the Gemara learns in other places. Dmehem bam teaches us skila. Therefore, the punishment is skila in these cases. That's both for the individual and for the animal. And then, on top of that, you have the hekesh between the animal and the person. And that tells you that the same way, or the same beit din that tries the individual, will also have to try the behema, or put the behema to death. Now, those are standard types or engagements of bestiality. In one case is where the male is the active partner, and the other one is the female, where she is the passive partner. And so that is the normal way that it would happen, and that's what the Gemara says over here. Kaposik vitani. Over here, it says in the Mishnah, without any qualification, that bestiality is subject to these dinim. Loshna roveh zachar, loshna roveh nikeva. It doesn't make a difference whether the roveya is a zachar, or the roveya is a nikeva. So now the Gemara explains. Bishlomo roveya nikeva dichtiv. It makes sense that when you're talking about an animal that performs an act where they are the male is the animal and the female is the passive is the human being, then over there we know that the penalties that are assigned to both of them is a death penalty. That's the pasuk that we just read together. Elo roveya zachar Minolon, how do we know that if you have a male animal that consorts, if you can say that, with a male, meaning that there's sodomy that's being performed by an animal on a human being, how do we know that that will also result in a death penalty? Because the psukim don't address that issue. Dichtiv, so the Gemara says, well, it is, because it says, Koshochevim beima mot yumat. Anybody who sleeps with an animal will be subject to a death penalty. Im enu inyan l'shochev. If it's not for someone who's sleeping with an animal, tneu inyan l'nishkav. Then let us talk about a case where the person, or the male, the zachar, is the receiving end of this relationship, rather than the active partner in the relationship. And that's because we already have the pasuk that I read you before, which is ish asher yiten shkavto bebeima mot yumat tebeima tarogu. So we already know when the male is, or the person is the active partner in that bestiality, that they're subject to a death penalty. How do we know when it's the other way around, that you have a male behema and a male partner on the human side who is the passive partner? How do we know that that's the case? We say, well, the pasuk in Shmot seems to be extraneous, which is ko shochev in behema mot yumat. So over there, shochev leaves it more ambiguous about who the shochev is. So the Gemara says, menu inyan the shochev, tenu inyan the nishkav. If it's not the active shochev, but the nishkav, the passive partner, va'afkei rachmanav lashon shochev. So then why did the Torah use the word shochev if it meant nishkav? Akushe nishkav l'shochev. To teach you that the same din that applies to a shochev will apply to a nishkav. Ma shochev hu ubeemto besrim v'shlosha. Just like by the case of bestiality, where we read the pasuk, "Ish asher yiten shkavto bebeima mot yumat et beima tarogu," over there you require 23, and there's a death penalty. Af nishkav hu ubeemto besrim v'shlosha. So too, it's the other way around, where the animal is acting as the active partner and sodomizing the human being, that in that case you'd also result in a death penalty for both of them, as well as the need to try them in a court of 23. In all these instances, there's no differentiation but for the behema being active, not active, or innocent, not innocent. The animal is not the factor. It's the human being that's the problem in all of these situations. The human being gets a death penalty. That's what we're seeing here. And the animal, because of that, or as a result of that, also ends up with a death penalty, irrespective of their, quote-unquote, responsibility in the issue. Shor Niskal, Besrim Shlosha. So Shor Niskal gets 23. That's what the Mishnah says. Shinemar, the Pasuk says, Shor Yisakel, Balav Yumat. Pasuk says that the shor gets the death penalty, and the owners also are subject to death. Now, this is a case where the shor kills a human being. When he kills a human being, the shor itself will be put to death, and then the owners will also have a death sentence associated with them. Kemitat ha-balim, kach mitat ha-shor. You saw this again in the Mishnah, and we discussed it, that in essence, the mitat ha-shor will follow the protocol of the death of the balim. So just like if it was a capital case for the balim, it would require 23, so too for the mitat ha-shor, we require 23. Amalei Abaye, the Rova, Mimai Dahai, Vegam Belav Yumat, Mitat HaBalim, Kach Mitat HaShor. How do you know that the point of Gam Belav Yumat is coming to bring you this Hekesh, which says to you, just like the death of the Balim would have this protocol, so too the death of the shor has that same protocol. Maybe, Ema, let us suggest the Katala Hudata. Maybe it's coming to tell you that the owner of the shor gets a death penalty. So what you see from this is that until now, the Gemara assumed that the Balim would not get a death penalty. And that's why they used it for the Hekesh. That leads to a number of questions that are raised by the Balei HaTosafot over here, and the Rishonim deal with it in different ways. But the question that the Balei HaTosafot say is, why can't you know both of them? Just because the Balav Yumat means that the Balim would literally be killed in this case for the situation, why does that then eliminate the possibility of making a Hekesh between the Balim and the Shor? The Hekesh comes from their juxtaposition in the Pasuk. It doesn't come from the fact that the Balim die or don't die. So then why can't you have both Limudim happen? The truth is, that's exactly what just happened in the previous case with bestiality. Over there we said that the Torah specifies a death penalty for both the human being and the animal. And then we said there's a Hekesh between them. So despite the fact that they're both subject to a death penalty, we said there's a Hekesh because they're found in the same Pasuk. That the Balei HaTosafot take up with, first of all, the difference in language between the case of bestiality and the case here, where the shor of an individual kills, and then the order of the pasuk also might matter. So the Balei HaTosafot, using that, try to say that the order of the pasuk and the language and the way that it's laid out makes it different over here than it was by bestiality. And therefore, we thought mitat ha-balim was literally the death of the balim, we wouldn't have the hekesh. That's one way that Tosafot deals with it. At the way end, the Balei HaTosafot suggests that maybe Abai's question is not exclusive in nature, and this is the way that many of the other Rishonim view it, which is, Abaye here is not coming to say, oh, maybe it means mitata balim, meaning it's a death penalty of the balim, and that would be to the exclusion of the hekesh. What he's saying is, how do you know that it's the only reason mitata balim is mentioned over here is for the hekesh, and not to tell you literally that the person is subject to a death penalty? How do you know that the balim, the owners over here, are not subject to a death penalty? And that would be the way to phrase the question, not to eliminate the hekesh, but to say on top of the hekesh, you should also really have a literal death sentence they carried out on this individual. So when it says, im ken lichtov gam ba'alav velishtok, because then the pasuk just should have said, and also the owner, and stop there. Why does it use the term yumat? Ikatav rachmana hachi, the Gemara says, havamina biskila, then you would think that the owners are subject to skila. Biskila, sakadatcha? How could you think that the owner is going to get a punishment of skila? Katal ihu bisayif. If he himself literally killed someone else, then he'd be subject to a death penalty by the sword, by saif. Mimono biskila. Now you're going to suggest that if his possession killed, that you're going to assign the responsibility to him to the point where he's going to get a death sentence of skila. Skila, as we'll see later on in the Masechta, is the most severe of punishments. Saif is either the first or second from the bottom, meaning in terms of a kula. So if when a person kills by their own hands, they killed someone else, they're subject to a death penalty by the saif, then an individual whose possession's killed, you're going to say now that they get a higher or more severe death sentence? That makes no sense. So you would never say something like that. So the Gemara says, "Bedoma haydech tov rachmana yumat lakula ilave." Maybe it's the other way around. Maybe it tells you yumat to tell you that you should go to a lighter sentence. Lafuke misayif lechenek, to say to you that you drop down from saif, death by the sword, to chenek, death by choking, which would be the lightest form of mitah. Where it says, "Anichal man damar chenek chamur," it makes sense according to the one who says that saif is the lightest form of death penalty and chenek is more severe than that. Then you don't have a question over here, because then there's nothing to drop down to. You're already at the lowest death sentence for murder. Then for a shor haniskal, or the case where your possessions kill someone else, then there'd be no reason to believe that you should get a different death sentence than that. And therefore the word yumat would not be necessary over there. And that's why you would have the word yumat teaching you that there is a hekesh over here. On the other hand, if you believe that saif is the second from the bottom, meaning it's more severe than chenek, then there's a possibility here that the reason it says v'gam yubalav yumat is coming to teach you that the balim should get a different penalty than what you would get normally for murder. So now, that's what it says. L'manda mar chenek kiyo, the one who says the chenek is a lighter form of punishment than saif, ma'ika l'meymar. What are you going to say over here? At first we thought that if you didn't have the yumat, you would upgrade him to skila like the behema. Where it says that's ridiculous, that makes no sense. Because how could it be that his possession of doing a killing is more severe than he himself killing? So then the Gemara says, okay, let's look at the other way around. Maybe if you left out the word yumat, it might be that you would think that he gets a lighter sentence over here because it's just his possessions that are killing, not he himself that's killing. Therefore, the word yumat comes along to teach you that he gets the same death penalty here as he would if he killed himself. So the Gemara says, that's the question then. You would not think to say that, because the pasuk says, im kofer yushat alav. He pays kofer in lieu of the death penalty. So now, when you have the ability to pay to get out of a death penalty, you know that there's no death penalty. Why? If you think he really was subject to a death penalty, the nefesh rotzeach. The pasuk says in the end of Parshat Maaseh, you can't pay to get out of a death sentence. I mean that when you're subject to a death sentence, that's what you're going to get. If you can pay to get out of it, that means that it's not a death sentence. So that's why over here also, if you can pay kofar to free yourself of the death penalty, that tells you that when the pasuk says that gam balav yumat, you can't take it literally. You can't look at that and say that he's really subject to a death penalty. So adaraba, Amar says, logically actually say the opposite. Mishum hi gufa. Because of exactly what you're saying, there's a distinction here. Katal ihu. If he killed himself, if he murdered, lo tiske lebe mamona, ela biktala, kofar would not be good enough. You can't pay to get out of a death penalty then, because that's the only right punishment for you. It's not sufficient with money, you have to actually give him a death sentence. Katal shoro, on the other hand, if his possession killed, lifrok nafshe be mamona, that's a lighter form of killing, because it wasn't he himself that did it, but his money, his possession that did it. And therefore, maybe it would be okay for him to be redeemed or use kofar. So the Gemara says that proof is not a good proof, because there where the Torah specifically says that you cannot use kofar, you cannot use money to buy your way out of a death sentence, that would only be true where it was murder. But in a case where it's your possession that killed, maybe that's exactly why you're allowed to buy your way out, because you're not a murderer in that case. The pasuk says, that the murderer is put to death because he is a killer. He's the one who murdered. For his murder, meaning that the person who murders, he will be put to death. But he will not be put to death for the killing of his possessions, meaning that his possessions that kill will not cause him a death penalty. And from that limud, we know that the Baalim are not subject to a death penalty. So now, once you've done that, the gam balav yumat in the pasuk is not literal, because the Baalim are not going to be subject to a death penalty. Therefore, you have to take it figuratively. That's why, number one, you're allowed to use kofar to get out of it. Number two, why we can use that pasuk for a hekesh, because it's available now. Gam balav yumat is not literal, and therefore now it's available for a hekesh, even though, as the Baalim Tosafot point out, that the yumat over here can mean mita bidei shamayim, which is what it means. It doesn't mean that you'll be killed by Beit Din, you'll still be subject to a death penalty in shamayim unless you pay for the kofar, unless you rectify the situation. So for that reason, we have the availability of the hekesh, and that's what teaches us that shor niskal has to be tried in a Beit Din of 23, just like the Baalim would be if they were subject to a death penalty. Now the fact that you actually need 23 for the death penalty of an animal seems a little strange, because in essence, it's not really a capital crime anymore. It's really mamon hamazik. It's your possessions that did damage, and the animal's being put to death because of that mamonot, an issue of monetary matters. So for that reason, you have to either look at this as a gzerat hakatuf, that the gzerat hakatuf is, despite the fact that we're dealing with a monetary matter, nevertheless it's viewed like a capital crime, and therefore you require a beit din of 23. Or you have to view the fact that this animal killed, and we say in the pasuk "Gam balav yumat," that the owners are really subject to a death penalty, that despite the fact that the Torah says you will not be put to death for the murders committed by your possessions, nevertheless, there is a certain amount of culpability here that makes it into a capital crime, and we're not going to look at it just as a monetary matter. It really is a capital crime, and you have to take this very seriously. The culpability and the responsibility that lays with you is very serious over here. And despite the fact that you escape the death penalty, that doesn't mean that there wasn't murder that took place here that you are somewhat responsible for. Or there's another possibility, which is brought by the Ramban, which is that this relates to the pasuk by the Shiva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, which the pasuk there over says, V'achet dimchem l'nafshu techem edrosh miyad kol chaya edreshenu, miyad ha'adam yad ish achiv edrosh et nefesh ha'adam. That over there, the Torah says that anybody who kills a human being, that kills the Tzelem Elokim, whether it's a human being or whether it's an animal, God will hold them responsible for that. And therefore, the killing of an individual, whether it's done by man or whether it's done by animal, is subject to the same din, or considered a capital crime, based on what it says by the Shiva Mitzvah B'nei Noach that are said over to Noach after he exits the Teva. Now, Ibailahu, Shor Sinai, a shore by Har Sinai, Bikama. How many individuals of a Beit Din do they need to put it to death? Migamar Sha'a Midorot. Do we learn out something that happened once in a lifetime was a historical event? Do we learn that out from something that is the halacha all the time? Olo, or maybe not. Tashma. Well, let's learn this. Why? The Tani Rami Bar Chezkel. Im Behema Imish Lo Yechye. It says there by Har Sinai that anybody who steps onto the mountain when Hashem is giving the Torah, they will be subject to a death penalty. Im be'ema imish. Whether it's an animal, whether it's a human being, lo yechia, they will not live. Ma'ish b'kaf gimel, af be'ema b'kaf gimel. Just like a person has to be tried with a Beit Din of 23, so too an animal has to be tried with a Beit Din of 23, and therefore also by Har Sinai, if an animal stepped onto the mountain, it would have to be brought before a Beit Din of 23, just like an individual who went onto the mountain when they weren't supposed to at Har Sinai, would be subject to a death penalty that would require a Beit Din of 23 for capital punishment. Now, the Baalei Tosafot ask over here, and it is a serious issue, which is that the Gemara in many other places says, Madahava Hava. Why do we care about anything that's historic? When you're talking about halacha that has implications, the Dorot, then it makes sense to investigate or understand the situation. But over here, when we're talking about Har Sinai, which was a one-time event in history, and there was a death penalty for going on Har Sinai, why does it matter what the Beit Din that is needed to try a shor in that case? it's not meaningful at all. So the Baalei Tosafot here say either it's to understand the psukim, so we want to really understand what the psukim mean, and this helps us to understand what the psukim mean, or you could say that it's a more fundamental question about learning sha'a mi dorot, or vice versa, learning dorot mi sha'a. How open is that channel to learn from one to the other? Are we allowed to learn from historical events and then extrapolate that to events that are recurring or in the future are halachot that are meaningful? Or is that not? I mean, that when we look at something that's the sha'a, it's particular to that event and you cannot extrapolate from it. You can't use it as a paradigm in any way. That might be the question of the Gemara. It's in reverse here because it's going from dorot to sha'a, but in vice versa, you'd have the same question. So that might be the nature of the Gemara's question. And then the Gemara goes to something there in particular and says, no, we can't learn it from dorot. Or it's trying to explain the psukim, and this helps us to understand the psukim by Har Sinai. Okay, now the Gemara goes on to the next piece of the Mishnah, which is other animals that are subject to a death penalty. Just a note over here, the Gemara is quoting the animals that are mentioned in the Mishnah. Over here, Rashi tells you one of those animals that's mentioned in the Mishnah is a bartalus. When we discussed in the Mishnah, we discussed the difficulty of explaining what a bartalus is. Rashi over here gives the la'az, the old French, for what it is, and he calls it a poitvish. Tosafot over here takes issue with Rashi's explanation of the poitvish. He says that that's too small an animal. That's a very small animal, and therefore it wouldn't be so dangerous to human beings. You wouldn't have expected that to be in a list of animals like a bear and a lion when you're talking about a bartalus. Rashi's interpretation of poitvish over here is either probably a mongoose or a skunk. And Tosafot says those aren't types of animals that you worry about them killing other people that you would say can't be domesticated to the point where they're dangerous to society as a whole. And therefore, the Baalei Tosafot say that the bartalus over here must be either a nachash, must be some sort of serpent or snake that we're speaking about, or the other possibility is that this bartalus is more along the lines of a cheetah or a feline type of animal that is strong and dangerous, like the others that are mentioned in the Mishnah. And then the Baalei Tosafot finally comes around and says, you know what? This word bartalus shows up many places in Shas, and when you look in the different cases, sometimes it makes sense what Rashi's saying, sometimes it makes sense what we're saying, and maybe the word bartalus has numerous meanings, that there are different animals with this name. For instance, the case in the Mishnah in Psachim that says if you have a case where you have a chulda or bartalus that comes around that can move the chametz around, so over there you can't be talking about some large dangerous animal. Over there where you're speaking about small rodents, which unbeknownst to you are moving a chametz around, which are animals or small animals, then the Rashi's definition over here would make sense. Versus in our case over here, where Rashi's definition would not make sense, and that's why Tosafot says maybe we need to rethink that the word bartalus doesn't always mean the same thing every time you see it in Shas. And over there, the Mishnah has a list of animals where they are considered for a possible death penalty. And we have three opinions over there about what you have to do. There's the Tanakama, then there's Rabbi Eliezer, and then there is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Tanakama says that you need a Beit Din of Chof Gimel. Rabbi Eliezer says the first one to kill them, the vigilante, is rewarded. And then Rabbi Akiva says the same thing as the Tanakama, which is you need a Beit Din of Chav Gimel. So now the Gemara wants to understand these opinions. Amar Reish Lakish, Behu, Shehem Itu. Even Rabbi Eliezer, who says that a person can be a vigilante and kill these animals because they're dangerous, that's only if they have already killed someone. So the difference between him and the Tanakama will be whether you have to go through the regular protocol of Beit Din. When an animal like this, which is tends not to be domesticated, tends to be a dangerous animal, if it kills, do you have to then take it to a Beit Din of 23 and go through the normal processing of Beit Din? Or do we say, kol dekodem zacha, that the first one to kill him is a benefit to society because these animals are just so dangerous? And they've already demonstrated that they're not domesticated because they killed. We need to rid ourselves of them as fast as possible. And therefore, the person who does it is rewarded for that. Elohimitu, if they did not kill, then lo, then you don't have a right. So according to Reish Lakish, it's only if they've killed does that open the a possibility of being you being a vigilante. But before they kill, there is no such concept. So it's only Behushe Mitu. Alma, Kasavar, Reish Lakish must believe, Yeshlen Tarbut, these animals, despite their danger, can be domesticated. Yeshlen Balin, and since they can be domesticated, they have owners to them. So number one, if they have owners, they're not Hefker. And so if you take them, steal them, or anything else, they are considered to be owned, and then there are repercussions to that. As well as the fact that they are considered to be domesticated. Since they are domesticated, people can keep them in their house as long as they take the proper precautions, and you don't have a right to eliminate them or to wipe them out or kill them in anticipation of what they could do. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Afo Pish Lo Emitu. Even if the animals have yet to kill, Rabbi Eliezer believes you have a right to kill them preemptively. Alma Kasava, Rabbi Yochanan must believe that this is Rabbi Eliezer's opinion. Einlahem tarbut, these animals cannot be domesticated. Einlahem balim, and they do not have owners. Because they can't be domesticated, you're never considered to be an owner of the animal. Because if you can't domesticate it, how could you own the animal? By definition, it doesn't accept ownership or mastership over it. If that's the case, then you never can be the owner. It's always hefker. It's always independent of your ownership. The Balei Tosafot here discuss the fact that in Baba Kama, Gemara seems to indicate over there that Rabbi Elazar believes that these animals can be domesticated and therefore you have to pay domestic shalem. So the Rabbeinu Tam says, well, don't worry about it. Here it's Rabbi Eliezer and over there it's Rabbi Elazar. So there are two different authors of those opinions and there's no stira. Although the Balei Tosafot in the end say, v'yesh shema yesh lechalek. Maybe there's to be a distinction. That over here, maybe when we say that they are able to be domesticated, that's because these animals have the possibility of being domesticated. With regards to Nezek Shalem, they're considered to be a mu'ad from day one, which is that the ability to domesticate them doesn't change the fact that these are dangerous animals. And just because you domesticated them doesn't mean they all of a sudden become tam. They're still a mu'at. And so there, Tosfot says you could say that despite the fact that here you believe they're domesticated, over there you don't have to believe they're domesticated. As well as with the Rabbeinu Tam says over here, that tarbut ahatam hu shigidlem bebeito. That tarbut over there in the Gemara of Baba Kama means that they grew up in your house. Whereas the tarbut over here is that you brought them in and now you've tied them up or you're chaining them up. Meaning that you've captured them later on in their life and now you're trying to domesticate them. That's a different type of domestication. Because if it grows up in your house, there's a possibility of domestication. Over here, where they are taken from the wild, and now you're capturing them, over there we don't believe there's a possibility of domestication. Anyway, there are ways to differentiate, but it's interesting to note, because it may be that the din that we have here may be different than that of Baba Kama, but it might also depend on what you're looking at. Are you looking at the responsibility for Nezek, or are we looking at the ability to stop other people from killing these animals preemptively? So now the Gemara says, it's not. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, so whoever comes first, whoever is the first in line or vigilante to kill them, is zoche. Then what did you successfully get? Zachala oran. Then you get their skins. Because according to Rabbi Yochanan, they have no ownership. Since they have no ownership, they're hefker. And when you kill them, then you get the reward of keeping the skins because you, in a sense, took possession of them in killing them. Ela Reish Lakish, the maizacha. According to Reish Lakish, where there are real owners to this animal, if you kill it, that doesn't all of a sudden give you the right to take the skins. The orot, the hides, would belong to the original owner. And where it says, no, kevin shi mitu, shavinu rabbanon keman degomar dinaihu, since these animals are already killed, the rabbanon have made it as if they've reached a gemar din, and therefore they are subject to execution, and therefore isrei hana ninhu. They are considered to be isrei hana. So they might zacha. So then what does it mean, zoche? He's not zoche, and if it's Yisra Hana'ah, you can't be zoche in it. Zacha l'shamayim. They belong to God now. Meaning they become Yisra Hana'ah. So just like a shor niskal, an animal that is brought to trial for killing a human being, that animal is asur b'hana'ah. Once they reach a gemar din, that it's subject to a death penalty, that animal becomes asur b'hana'ah, and the balim would get nothing of that animal. Whether the animal runs away, whether the animal is put to death, the animal is asur b'hana'ah. And what we're saying here, according to Reish Lakish, is that since these animals are subject to a death penalty, similar to the case of Shor Niskal, because Rabbi Reish Lakish says they have to kill first before they're a chayav, what Rabbi Eliezer is saying is that they basically get an accelerated sentence, which is that in the case of the Tanakama, you'd have to bring them to trial in a Beit Din of 23. According to Rabbi Eliezer, you don't have to go through that. You simply can kill them because it's as if the Gemar Din was already given in this case. Where it says, Tanya Kavati the Rabbi Reish Lakish, we have a bright that supports Reish Lakish's position. Echad shor sheimit, echad beima v'chaya sheimitu v'chav gimel. Whether it's an animal shor that killed, or whether it's a beima or chaya that killed, all of them are subject to a beit din of chav gimel. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, shor sheimit besrim b'shlosha. If it's an animal like a shor that killed, then like the Torah says, it is subject to the regular protocols of beit din in 23. B'shar beima v'chaya sheimitu, other animals that are not like a shor, that are not domesticated, whoever kills them first is rewarded min ha-shamayim or grants them to shamayim because they become isrei hana'ah at that point in time. Rabbi Kiva Omer, Rabbi Kiva hainu Tanakama. Rabbi Kiva is saying the same thing as the Tanakama, that you require a beit din of 23. where it says, Ikabinayu nachash. The difference between them is a snake, which is a snake domesticable? Tanakama says that the nachash is included in the list of the remaining items over there. Therefore, it has the same requirements or same protocols as all the other animals, which means 23 of Beit Din 23. Rabbi Akiva agrees with him with all the other animals, with the exception of the nachash, that the nachash is something that's so dangerous and something that is not able to be domesticated, and therefore he agrees with there, the Rabbi Eliezer, that it's not subject to a Beit Din of 23, but rather, kol kodem zacha, that whoever gets there first and kills the animal is zoche, and according to Reish Lakish, it would be zoche l'shamayim. What's interesting over here is that since we have a bright to support in Reish Lakish, that would seem to indicate that we pass from like Reish Lakish over Rabbi Yochanan, and that's what the Baalei Tosfot ask over here, why is it that this is not included in the list of times where we pass from like Reish Lakish over Rabbi Yochanan? And the answer that Tosfot gives is because here it's not their personal opinions. Here it's not Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish arguing about their own positions, but rather it's they're arguing within the position of Rabbi Eliezer. What did Rabbi Eliezer mean? So here, yes, the halacha is like Reish Lakish because of a bright that supports him, but it's not included in the instances where we say we pass from like Reish Lakish versus Rabbi Yochanan, because that is speaking about cases where they're arguing about their own opinions versus each other. Here, they're arguing about what is the meaning of Rabbi Eliezer's opinion in the Mishnah. Okay, now, Gemara continues, Ein Danim. Now, when it comes to a Shevet, you can't be done the Shevet except with the Beit Din of Shivim Ve'achad. Gemara says, Hai Shevet Techata B'mai. What exactly did this Shevet do that they require the Beit Din of Gadol to adjudicate the case? Ilema Shevet Shechilel Et HaShabbat, the entire Shevet was Mechalel Shabbat, we know that the Torah distinguishes between an individual that worships Avodah Zarah versus a large number of people, an Irani Dachat that worships Avodah Zarah. There the Torah has different prescriptions for each of the individual versus the Rabbim. But Shar Mitzvot Mipolik. Since when in other Mitzvot do we have a distinction between the penalty that's assigned to the Yachid versus the penalty that's assigned to the Rabbim? So why should it be different for an individual's Mechalel Shabbat versus a Shevet that is Mechalel Shabbat? Ella b'shevet shehudach. It must be a case where you have a shevet that is classified as a ir hanidachat, meaning that they all worship Avodah Zarah. They've been convinced to worship Avodah Zarah. L'memra d'bidin of derabim d'anin le. So now you're telling me that when you have an entire shevet that worships Avodah Zarah, is convinced to worship Avodah Zarah, they have the same status as an ir hanidachat, not the status of individuals. Come on. Who's that like? Lo k'Rabbi Yoshaya v'lo k'Rabbi Yonatan. It's like neither of these Tanaim who tell us what the qualifications of an Irani Dachat are. Tatanya, Ad Kamo Osim Irani Dachat. How many people are classified to be an ear for an Irani Dachat? So, Miyud Bad Kaf. If the members or the citizens of the city are from 10 into 100, Divi Rabbi Oshaya. That's Rabbi Oshaya's view. On the other hand, Rabbi Yonatan Omer, Mikaf Fad Rubo Shel Shevet. It's from 100 members of a city up to the rove of a Shevet who we classified as an Irani Dachat. Baalei Tosafot say over here that they're arguing based on the pasuk in Amos that says Kiko Amar Hashem Elukim Ha'ir Hayotzei Elif Tashir Me'a, a city that once boasted 1,000 citizens will now only have 100 Hayotzei Me'a, and a city that in the past had 100 citizens in it Tashir Asara will only be have a remnant of 10 left of Beit Yisrael. It's talking about the Churban of Eretz Yisrael and saying that the cities will be reduced. So here you have an assignment of cities from 1,000 to 100 and 100 to 10. So Tosfot says he thinks that's where their machloka comes, is about what the definition of a city is. The definition of a city, 100 to 1,000 in a sense, or is it the definition of a city from 10 to 100? So, but either way, the Gemara concludes here, Afilu Rabbi Yonatan, even Rabbi Yonatan who thinks you can have a very large city and still be an Irani Dachat, Lo Kamar La Rubo. He only says that if it's the majority of the Shevet, Elu Kulo Lo, it's the entire Shevet, he does not believe that that is subject to the laws of Irani Dachat. So how can you suggest over here that the entire Shevet that sins in Avodah Zarah will have a din of an Irani Dachat? Samar of Matna Hocha Benasi Shevet Shechata Askina. We're dealing here with the leader of the Shevet, the prince, the governor, whatever you want to call that position, but the leader of the Shevet sinned over here. Mi lo amar Rav Adar Ba'ava, kol ha-davar ha-gadol yaviu elecha. Anything that is too big, they're going to bring to you, Moshe Rabbeinu. Dvarav shel gadol doesn't mean things that are too hard or too big for us to deal, we're going to bring to you. Rather, things that deal with the big guns, we're going to bring to you. So, hainami gadol hu. This is also someone who is a gadol, meaning that sometimes the gadol comes about because you have a big case or a difficult case, but sometimes the gadol comes about because of the power or the position of the individual. And that's what it means over here. We're talking about not a Shevet Shechata, but the Nasi Shevet Shechata. But that's so big or such a big issue that they must be tried by the Beit Din of 71, because that's the only appropriate place to take someone in that type of position or status to trial. Ula Amar Rabbi Lazar, Bibayin Aliske Nechalot. It's the case where they're coming to dispute their property inheritance. Similar to the original assignment of properties in Eretz Yisrael. How do they divide up Eretz Yisrael between the Shvatim? Matchilata 71. Just like in the original division of Eretz Yisrael, you required a Beit Din of 71. Avkan 71. So too, when there's a matter of dispute with regards to Nachalot, we're going to have to bring it to the Beit Din of 71. It seems to be here that the dispute is a shevet-to-shevet dispute about property. Ima tchilata kalpi urim v'tumim v'chol Yisrael. If you're going to tell me you're going to compare the disputes about property or inheritance now to the original distribution of the property, and that's how we know you need a Beit Din shel Shivim Echad, then you should need all the trappings, like it was done the first time. The first time it was done not only with the Beit Din shel Shivim Echad, it was also done with the kalpi, meaning that they did it through a lottery, and also through the Urim V'Tumim, that they asked the Urim V'Tumim and tried to match up the Shevet with the property. And all of Bnei Yisrael were present for that. So to over here, you're going to have to do the same thing. Afkan, Kalpi, Urim V'Tumim, B'chol Yisrael. Here too, you're going to need all of that in order to adjudicate a case that deals with Nachalot. That seems ludicrous. Elim Echavarta, Kerab Matna. Makes more sense, the explanation of Rab Matna, which was speaking about the Neshiva Shevet, and not what Ulis suggested over here, that we're speaking about Iskei Nechalot. Ravina Amar, Lolam B'Shevet Shehudach. We're talking about, like we originally thought, a Shevet that was convinced to worship Avodah Zarah. The Kashalach, B'dina D'Rabim D'Aninan Lei? So now you're going to tell me, oh, it gets the subject to the din of a Gira Nidachat. Din of Rabbi Yonatan and Rabbi Shai, who argued about the size of a Nidachat, neither of them said that a full Shevet could be classified as a Nidachat. Where it says, in. Yes, that's what's going to happen here. Afgav D'Katlina Nebi Yachid. You're right. Rabbi Yonatan and Rabbi Shai are talking about what death penalty will be assigned to the individuals. We speak of an Irani Dachat, the punishment for people of an Irani Dachat is Besaif. The punishment for an individual that worships Avodah Zarah is Skila. So now, what we're going to say is that the death penalty that's going to be assigned over here is going to be the death penalty of a Yachid. They're not classified as an Irani Dachat because they're too big to be an Irani Dachat. Therefore, they go back to being assigned the punishment of individuals, that means they'll be subject to skila for their worshiping of Avodah Zarah. But nevertheless, Beidina de Rabim Dainina Lei, nevertheless, they still have a status of being a Rabim or similar to an Inner Dachat in this manner, which is that they will require a Beit Din of Shivim Shel Echad and not be enough that they go to a regular Beit Din of 23 for like a capital crime of an individual. So that would be the bifurcation of the Din over here. They will say that the protocol that we use over here will be the protocol of an Irani Dachat. Just like an Irani Dachat requires Shivim Ve'achad, so too a whole Shevet that worships Avodah Zarah will require Shivim Ve'achad. On the other hand, Irani Dachat has specific qualifications, and this is not classified as an Irani Dachat. Therefore, they'll be subject to the penalty of worshiping Avodah Zarah, a Yachid, and not that of the Rabbim. And Lilo Amar Rab Chamar Bar Rab Yossi Amar Rab Oshaya, Votzeta Et Aishahu, O Et Aishahi, that you will take out these individuals, El Shearecha, to the gateways, to the entrances of your city, and that's where they're going to be tried. That's the Beit Din, or the Sanhedrin Aktana, which are the Batei Dinim that sit in Shearecha, that sit in your gateways. So now, those that sit in your gateways, which are the Sanhedrin Aktana, they're good enough for Ish Visha, Tamotzi the Shearecha. If you're talking about individuals, you take them out to Sanhedrin Aktana, to your Shearim. V'yata Motzi Kol Ha'ir Kulo the Shearecha. Then you don't take the entire city or the entire Shevet out to your Sha'ar in order to be adjudicated. Hachanami. So too, over here in our case, Ish Vishata Motzei L'Sha'arecha, if there are individuals, you will take them out to a Beit Din of 23, the Sanhedrin that's in your Sha'ar, the Sanhedrin Aktana. V'yata Motzei Kol Shevet Kulo L'Sha'arecha. On the other hand, if it's a whole Shevet, that doesn't work because it's an Ish or Isha. Individuals are subject to the Sanhedrin Aktana of your Sha'ar. But if it's a whole Shevet, they're not subject to Sanhedrin Ktana of the Shaar. Rather, they need a Beit Din of 71. So that's the difference over here. You're right. It's not an Irani Dachat when the whole Shevet worships Avodah Zarah, is convinced to worship Avodah Zarah. But nevertheless, they will have the same Din as Irani Dachat, which is just like when we look at individuals, they are allowed to be tried in capital crimes or capital cases by a Beit Din of 23. But that's individuals, not Irani Dachat, and not a whole Shevet. They will both require 71. Now, when it comes to the penalty, when it comes to the sentencing of these individuals, when it comes to an Iri Dachet, it has its own protocol, which is death by Saif. On the other hand, when it comes to a Shevet, it no longer qualifies as an Iri Dachet, and therefore their death penalty would be the same death penalty as individuals, like any other Aveira in the Torah. If you're Mechalo Shabbat, whether it's a whole Shevet or individuals, they're all subject to the Din of Skila. And so to over here, individuals in the whole Shevet will be subject to the Din of Skila when it comes to the issue of Avodah Zarah. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots in the middle of Tetzayin Amud Aleph.